Thanks for tuning in to the Replatform podcast, sponsored by Attraction Hypersonics and hosted by myself, James Gerd. Warm welcome if it's your first time. We put a lot of effort into recording this content and bringing it to you for free. Help us keep it that way. Refer us to other people. Let them know we exist. Share it. Repost on, you know, LinkedIn and social when we put out our posts. And also, can you rate the show on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you're listening? Really helps boost our visibility and gives it that warm glow inside. So thanks, and we hope you enjoy the episode. So let me set this up, and then I'll introduce you to our guest. So our focus today is on driving more value from your cart to confirmation page journey with Rokt. So having recently talked about profit optimization for e-commerce with Hypersonics, we're drilling down into tech solution that helps e-commerce teams improve monetization of the on-site conversion funnel. And our focus is with the team at Rokt today. So we're going to cover things like the problems of Rokt is helping e-commerce businesses solve, how the technology is being used by retailers, and key product features of business tooling. So warm welcome to Bill Bolton, who's the Chief Product and Engineer Officer. Hi, Bill, how are you?
I'm doing fine this morning. It's great to be here with you.
Yeah, thanks so much for jumping on. I'm really looking forward to this as well, to learn a bit more about the product. I know you lead up the R&D efforts, but would you like to give our listeners a bit of a flavor for, you know, who you are, what you do, and what Rokt is?
Yeah, sure. As I said, I lead a product development, so that's product management, software engineering, machine learning science, data engineering, all of the disciplines that go into allowing us to build and operate our service. I joined Rokt about a year ago. Prior to that, I had spent 10 years at Amazon working on Alexa, but I've been having a great time at Rokt. Rokt is enjoying tremendous growth. It's just a great place to be.
Out of interest, do you still have Alexa on everywhere doing things for you, or have you reached the end after 10 years where you no longer want to hear her talk?
I used to have about 20 devices just all over the place. It was all Alexa all the time for me. but now that I'm out in the wild, I have a couple. We have one in our kitchen, and I use it mostly to ask for when the Boston Bruins will play their next ice hockey. Or what the score of the game was, and then I have one that I use to control the fans in my home gym.
So basically, living and breathing with 20 devices, that's like the Christian Bale method acting approach to technology, where you really embrace it.
Yeah, well, you know, when you're working on a product like that, there's nothing like eating your own dog food, as the expression goes, and I ate an awful lot of Alexa dog food.
Excellent. Well, let's get into Rokt, because I think it's quite an interesting technology platform, and I'm looking forward to learn a bit more, and I think it'll be really useful for our core e-commerce base to understand where it fits into the overall technology ecosystem. But let's start with, you know, the focus, from what I've understood, is on the cart to confirmation page purchase funnel. Can you walk us through, like, the most common user journeys that Rokt is part of on an e-commerce store, and what roles you play at each of those steps?
Yeah, sure thing. So as you said, Rokt focuses on what we call the transaction moment, which is really the user journey during the checkout experience on an e-commerce site. We don't try and solve problems around product selection and endemic advertising and the more top of funnel experiences. There are people who are great at that. Most notably, the e-commerce partners are often very good at that. So we help our e-commerce partners unlock additional value during the checkout experience. And I'll give you a typical user journey. As you may have picked up, I'm a big fan of ice hockey, the Boston Bruins. They're in the NHL playoffs. So let's say I went to Ticketmaster and I was looking to buy tickets for the next Boston Bruins playoff game. I go, I find my tickets, I put my tickets in the cart, and now I'm ready to actually buy them. So now I get to the first part where Rokt really helps a partner such as Ticketmaster unlock new value, which is what we call the cart review page. So you can picture it as a consumer. You've already put things in the cart. You're ready to purchase. And there's typically a page where you're just looking one last time at what's in the cart to make sure you actually want to buy it. On that cart review page, it's a great opportunity to help our partners unlock new value by presenting upsells, either upsells from their own offering or what we call cross-sells, upsells from third parties. So for example, on Ticketmaster, if I have those Bruins tickets in there, Ticketmaster might have the opportunity for me to add parking near the venue. You can sometimes buy VIP experiences at the venue.
You can picture third-party offers to buy Boston Bruins jerseys so that the family can show up with all their fan and logo wear on. So that cart review page is the first step of the user journey where Rokt can help a partner add value to the cart directly. Once you're happy with the cart, possibly including some of these Rokt-mediated upsells, and you hit that, yep, I want to buy it button, then you get to the payment page. And we're all familiar with that. You either have to enter a credit card, or perhaps if you're logged into the e-commerce partner, you might have one stored. But it's where you're choosing how you're going to pay for that cart. That payment page is traditionally a cost center for e-commerce partners. You know, they're paying basis points to the credit card providers, and so usually it's a place where their margins are eroding a little bit. With Rokt served offers from our payments marketplace, we can present offers for new forms of payment that the customer doesn't have, a credit card, a buy now, pay later offer. And we're able to do it in a way which does not affect conversion rate. We can dig into that later in the conversation. And it's just a great opportunity to connect customers with new forms of payment at a time when that's very much on their mind. And doing so, we unlock additional value for the e-commerce partner, Ticketmaster, in my example. Then once you've purchased, you get to the confirmation page. It typically says, oh, thanks for your purchase. That confirmation page is another great opportunity to put offers in front of customers. So it might say something like, oh, thanks for your purchase of the Bruins tickets. Your purchase has unlocked 3 free months of Hulu. You know, those types of offers. And we're able to deliver yet more value to the e-commerce partner. And at every step of the journey, we're presenting things which are relevant to the customer. So the customer engagement with the pages is high, and their engagement with the offers is extremely high.
Attract, your complete product discovery growth engine. Create relevant shopping experiences that convert into sales and grow online revenue with personalized search, merchandising, and recommendation solutions powered by AI. Find out more at attract.com.
I find that really interesting about the payments page, because most e-commerce teams I've ever worked with would be terrified about changing anything on that, anything other than get, because the traditional viewpoint is get them as quickly through checkout as possible to maximize your conversion rate and then try and bring in cross and upselling afterwards. And it's interesting you say, because there are, you know, that the call to confirmation page, I think more people are starting to realize is an opportunity page. I'd love you to talk us through about that payments page. And so in terms of, I guess there's two bits. There's number one is how do you make sure the offers are relevant? What's the engineering and the data piece that sits behind that? And B, how are you helping customers to accurately measure that so that they don't have, like, you know, because obviously things may work, but they sometimes don't work as well on particular websites.
Yeah, those are all great questions. And of course, you're right. The moment when a customer is about to hit that button and a charge is going to hit a credit card and the e-commerce partner is going to get paid is a super sensitive part of the transaction journey. And they're extremely protective of that moment. So let me talk about that first. We're able to measure our impact on the cart conversion rate, whether or not customers, in fact, end up purchasing the cart. And we're able to do experiments, and we're able to show that we have no statistically significant impact on that cart conversion rate, while also creating these opportunities for customers to engage with payment offers and thus unlock new value for the e-commerce partner. So on the whole, for the e-commerce partner, it's incremental revenue without negative impact on their conversion rate. Maybe let me pause there in case you have follow-up questions about that conversion rate issue, which you first.
No, I find it interesting because people are, obviously there's a balance between not wanting to impede user journeys, but also recognizing that people are under a lot of like cost pressures and trading pressures and wanting to drive profit. So I'd love to know, because the bit that I think a lot of times people struggle with when testing things is holdout tests, where you're able to validate a control cell that sees nothing versus the test cell that actually sees it, rather than just putting it on and measuring, you know, incrementally. How do you work? I think this would be a question a lot of teams would have, is how do you work to do the testing? Do you do the testing natively in terms of showing, not shown, or do you need the retailers, for example, to have an A/B testing platform like an Optimizely or an A/B Tasty to use?
I know Rock embeds A/B testing deeply within our platform, so we don't need our partners to do it for us. We can do it for the partners. We're always doing some amount of holdout so that we can measure incrementality and effects on things like cart conversion rate on the payment page. It's an integral part of the Rock platform, and so we're able to measure with rigor our impact on things like cart conversion rate. And by the way, everything I'm talking about that we're doing on the payment page extends to the things that we do on the cart review page and the confirmation page as well.
I guess the other interesting thing is you can reduce conversion rate marginally and increase overall profitability because of the incrementality of the cart size. So do you spend a lot of time with clients and measuring things like repeat purchase rates off people who've redeemed offers versus those who haven't? Is that something that clients typically look at, or is it more measured on that instant transaction?
Oh, no, we can look at things that affect lifetime value across, you know, repeat visitors. We certainly do that. I mean, the goal of the Rock Marketplace is to create lasting incremental value for our e-commerce partners and to create engaging experiences for customers. So if there's anything, any offer or content that we're putting in front of customers, it ends up having a negative impact, not just in the moment. So even not just on whether they convert on that cart or not, but whether, you know, their future repeat rates. We're extremely obsessed with not having any of those negative impacts. And you mentioned you can offset a negative impact if you're adding enough incremental value with the, for example, payment offers on a payment page. But we try and set a higher bar than that. So we're not just trying to be net positive. We're actually trying to make sure we don't affect the conversion rate and add incremental value on top of that.
And I've got a couple of questions around the integration because it links quite naturally. What is the integration requirement? My assumption would be this is like a client-side JavaScript, or do you do API server-side integrations for people depending on what the technical capabilities of the team are?
Yeah, we have a really broad array of integrations that our e-commerce partners on the supply side and our advertisers on the demand side of the platform can use. So there can be, we have a web SDK focused on JavaScript. We have mobile SDKs for native iOS, native Android, Flutter, React Native, Cordova. So we have a pretty wide range of those SDKs, and we also have direct APIs. If the clients on either side want to be calling to an API directly, we can do that as well. Often we have clients on one or the other side of the platform who use a mix. They might be using an SDK and tags on some of their web pages. They might be using an API to report certain types of events.
Okay. Again, another assumption would be that it's e-commerce platform agnostic. So it's not restricted to specific e-commerce platforms. Would that be a correct assumption? Or do you work more naturally with specific vendors like Salesforces, for example?
I'd say we're platform agnostic. So we can work with the partners with any of their types of platforms. So it can be a completely proprietary stack that the partner has built. If they're working with Salesforce, they can still integrate to us. We provide a nearly no code integration path for sellers on Shopify, for example. Our goal is to have as vibrant a marketplace as possible with as many partners on the supply side and as many advertisers and brands on the demand side. It's that robustness and richness of the two-sided marketplace, which really is part of the value that Rock brings. So we're always striving to make it easier for clients to onboard on both sides.
And just quickly coming back to that, the holdout test bit, because I think that's a really important thing for people to understand is within that, are you able to exclude or include specific user types or customer segments based on, you know, the data in the data layer is able to be passed to you? Because I know that some premium brands I work with, they have a specific extra VIP segment who they would never offer any third-party promotions to, but to their kind of aspirational audience. And actually, yes, they would because they want to monetize things.
Yes,
The answer is sort of yes, yes, and yes, depending on how you split up your set of questions. Now, part of it isn't just about holdout. Some of what you're getting to now, it is targeting. So brands and advertisers can control audiences that they'll reach with their campaigns. They can do that via demographics. They can target it to categories of e-commerce site. They have a lot of fine-grained control if they want it. So we're not just spraying an advertiser's campaigns all over the supply side of the marketplace. The advertiser has control, and that control can include who they want to reach and who they don't want to reach. And a particular form of that is advertisers who have already acquired a customer can choose to target everyone who's not already a customer. So you know, they're not going to be spending money trying to reach people who they already have as customers if their campaign is a customer acquisition campaign.
Hypersonics helps e-commerce companies make more profit every day. This AI-driven platform delivers recommendations for pricing and inventory that lead to bigger profits. Visit hypersonics.ai/podcast to get a free trial.
And from the merchant's point of view, the merchant that's putting these offers or promotions or upsells on their cart journey, What data points can you ingest in order for them to control what and when and who? So let's take that example of like a premium brand that's got a specific segment of people that it never wants to show this to. What data integrations do you typically have? Like, are you taking stuff directly out of the data layer? Are you integrating with CRMs? Like, how do you normally receive that information so that you can control the display of promotions?
Yeah, so both for the e-commerce partners on the supply side and the advertisers on the demand side, via whether it's the SDKs and or APIs that they're using to connect to the Rocket Marketplace, they can provide us a lot of what for each of them is first-party data. So the e-commerce partner can be providing us a lot of first-party data about that customer. The advertiser can be providing us with their campaigns on the demand side, first-party data they have about their customers. An essential part of the Rocked Marketplace is that Rocked operates as the trusted intermediary between the two. So we never cross-pollinate. We're not sharing data that an e-commerce partner gives us about their customer with the advertiser. We're not sharing advertiser data about their customer with the partner. Rocked in the middle is using all those data points to allow us to respect targeting and suppression that the clients may be configuring, and then also to optimize click-through rates and engagement and outcomes. But an essential part of the Rocked platform, again, is where it's essential to us to be that trusted intermediary. We're not sharing data across. We're not doing spooky retargeting. We're not building customer profiles that we use for any other purpose other than to create the most engaging opportunity for customers on those e-commerce sites.
I've got a question around multi-storefront, because one of the challenges, especially in SaaS world where people have installed third parties and they've got multiple storefronts, is needing multiple accounts, one for each storefront. I'd love to understand how Rock would work with an e-commerce business that's maybe got a UK site, a US site, an EU site, and wants to be able to control the targeting down to like country, regional, language level.
Yeah, well, we currently operate in 15 countries, 5 different languages, so that's very much a real issue for us. And there's no magic to it. We're able to target campaigns and match based on the country in which the e-commerce transaction is occurring, the language in which it's occurring. It's a native part of our platform to be able to ensure that the right content is delivered to the right people, and that includes country, language, in addition to other targeting criteria that we may have around demographics and, category of the e-commerce partner. So the multi-storefront, the country and the language are really just a couple of dimensions of what's a broad set of dimensions across which we can be doing targeting and matching.
But is it all accessed by one like central dashboard then, rather? Because on some apps, I know people have to have separate instances for each of the storefronts, which, whilst practical, whilst it works, adds like operational overhead. So are all the country targeting is all just through a single account, a single sign on then?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So for each advertiser, for example, we can manage their campaigns worldwide. For each partner, we can be managing their inventory worldwide. They don't have to log into, you know, different instances of the Rockt management platform. We run a worldwide marketplace.
Cool. And you talked briefly about the fact that like advertisers can control the where their inventory is displayed, because obviously they don't want to display it inappropriately or target people that aren't relevant. If we flip that to the merchant view, what controls do you give merchants to be able to decide what promotions and offers are relevant, or what partners they're willing to have? You know, what types of business that they don't want to be associated with? Can you talk people through what's automated versus what they can configure and control themselves?
Yeah, it's a very symmetrical, you know, balanced marketplace. So advertisers on the demand side can, you know, if they don't want their brand advertised on a certain category of e-commerce experience, for example, they can configure that. And similarly, on the e-commerce partner side, if they don't want certain brands advertising on their inventory, they can control that. You know, often, naturally, an e-commerce partner in, say, food delivery is not going to want to have ads from other people competing in food delivery. So they can say, okay, no food delivery campaigns on my food delivery inventory. Both sides are able to do that. Now, naturally, the less a client on either side of the marketplace is narrowing the inventory of the other side that they can be masked with, the more opportunity is, and there's probably more value we can unlock. But we can work with our clients, and you know, some of them are wide open, others have very narrow and specific requirements, and our platform enables both.
Yeah, so another point that I found quite interesting is that the product's designed to assess a customer's likelihood to engage. I think you alluded to earlier. So it's not just like peppering everybody with offers. I'd love to know this, because things like, you know, likelihood to engage, I think sometimes people can find, well, that sounds quite nebulous. So how is it calculated? What data points are used, and what signals influence that? Can you talk people through that piece, please?
Yeah, sure thing. The starting point is the e-commerce partner themselves. So they, as I said, can provide us a lot of information about their customer. And at that moment, where we're choosing what content to put in front of their customer in their checkout experience, we're really a solution provider to the e-commerce partner, and we act in their interests. And again, we're a trusted intermediary, so we can leverage a lot of the information about their customer to help predict over time their likelihood to engage with certain types of content. We can also use demographic data. So like, oh, this customer is a male in their 40s. Males in their 40s are more or less likely to engage with content from these advertisers. And then the advertisers themselves give us data, which helps us understand which customers are going to interact with their campaigns. And in the middle, we're able to build this model that predicts the likelihood of each individual customer to interact with a given campaign. But again, one thing we don't do is cross client boundaries. So for example, if we know from my interaction on Ticketmaster that I'm a hockey fan, and there's an advertiser out there, you know, the NHL.com logo wear shop, they can reach me if they want to target hockey fans on Ticketmaster, because Rockt knows I'm a hockey fan from my interactions on Ticketmaster. But they can't target me as a hockey fan on some different provider if the only way that Rockt knows I'm a hockey fan is from Ticketmaster. So we're very careful to maintain firewalls. And again, we're not doing some of the things which some people find spooky. We're on the right side of GDPR and Apple tracking transparency. So we're able to leverage a lot of data, but we do it in a pretty high hygiene, privacy respectful way.
Okay, cool. Interesting. How important is historical data for your algorithms? Because you've obviously got the learning piece where it's helping to automate and make smarter decisions based on, you know, all those data points coming from browsing and purchasing and profiles. But some sites, like a new site that's launched that hasn't got any historical data, like how would it work in that context? Or do people typically need a period of time for the algorithms to be able to glean any data before they can effectively start to make these promotion decisions?
Yeah, what you're describing is what we call the cold start problem. Mm. So first, yes, historical data is extremely powerful. And with modern machine learning modeling, the ability for deep learning models to improve their performance based on the more and more data you throw into the hopper at the top, including historical data, the better they perform. So we are able to leverage that. We're doing billions of transactions a year. So we have a lot of data that our models can learn from. Now, with a new partner on the supply side or a new advertiser on the demand side, and sometimes it's even an existing advertiser, but it's a new campaign, there is that cold start problem where you don't initially have data about that specific campaign, or maybe it's a new customer you're seeing through a new partner, and we haven't seen the customer before. But we're able to use, synthetic twin techniques and lookalike audiences that sort of give the models a good fresh start in those situations. So in a way, you're leveraging the historical data and the billions of transactions that we have to get a good starting point for a model of the customer and their propensity to engage with content. And then the models learn pretty quickly from there once things are actually live.
I know you said that you're not building up your own data profile of the customer. You're basically aggregating all the data points that are coming from like advertiser merchants. Do you within the permissions in terms of what you can do? Do you have like cross stitching based at like an ID level, like an email, a user's email, or are you just not touching PII then?
No, we do have internal to Rock, the customer data platform. So we are able to accumulate information about the customer via their interactions with RockServe content. Right? So it's our data. It's our view of the customer. So our e-commerce partners obviously have their view of the customer. Our advertisers have their view of the customer. And we have a view of the customer. So we can begin to learn what types of content a given customer engages with. But what we don't do, maybe the example I gave, like we wouldn't allow a sportswear advertiser to reach me, Bill Barton, as a hockey fan on an e-commerce site where the only reason we know I'm a hockey fan is from my interaction on Ticketmaster. So we have a lot of data, but we do maintain firewalls.
Yeah, understood. Yeah, that makes sense. And you talked about the testing and holdout tests, which is interesting. But can you talk us through the other A/B test options that you've got natively? Like what can people do? Is it about testing different advertiser strategies? Is it about creative testing? Like what can people change, I guess, in order to get, to push KPIs like conversion and revenue?
Yeah, we can run A/B tests on just about any dimension or a slice of the campaign and the targeting that we or our clients want. Certainly things like creative text, which phrasing of a credit card offer is going to be most appealing and likely to attract the most engagement. Should you talk about the low interest rate? Should you talk about other benefits of the card? Should you talk about balance transfer benefits and so on? So we're able to do A/B testing at that level, but for us, the magic isn't the ability to do A/B testing and say, oh, this is the better phrasing for that credit card for everyone. What we really want to be doing is leveraging that to feed what we call the efficient frontier, which is the ability of the models to learn that for a customer like me, a certain phrasing is going to be better. For a different customer, some other phrasing is going to be better. And making that decision on a per transaction, per customer basis, which is what in the field we call the efficient frontier. So A/B testing does help people get higher performance relative to not exploring between options A, B, or C. But it's using those experiments to feed the model so that now the models get it right per transaction. That's where we really get a great lift. Well,
that's really interesting, actually. So you can basically, I guess you can have an offer that's modularized then, and how it's presented varies from user to user based on the profile.
That's exactly. Yes. So A/B experiments have their place. We certainly do them. But to me, what they are is they're a seed for how to structure the variance in the advertiser content then our system is like, oh, we'll combine that font, that color, that phrasing, show an image, show the image small, show the image medium. And so we can synthesize what amounts to a customized ad unit for a specific customer and a specific transaction from a relatively small number of variations that the advertiser provides and how they describe the possibilities for that ad unit.
Yeah, that's nice. I mean, having done some testing on things like remarketing, on-site remarketing across territories, and seeing how even just subtle variances in image can have an impact in response and engagement rates. Yeah, that ability to learn and auto-apply it is very useful. Interesting.
And a key part of it is that we aren't just getting a static image. We're not just doing a display ad that has some sort of static image where we have no insight into what the actual content is, you know, with a click-through URL. We're getting structured data. And then we're synthesizing what the overall experience is for the customer on the partner site. So that's part of what allows us to do that manifold synthesis and optimization on a per customer basis.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I got one final question about the advertising network where you've got third-party offers that can be displayed into a site. You gave Ticketmaster as the example. So how does it work for a merchant? You've got your own marketplace, obviously people connect to, and the advertisers and the merchants can select and decide who does and doesn't appear. But how does it work for a merchant who's got potentially like two partners they have commercial agreements with and they want their offers featured, but they're not currently in your network? What's the vetting process that you bring? Can they bring anyone to the table, or how does it work?
Yeah, we can work across the full spectrum of that. So some merchants come to us and they have zero relationship with advertisers, and that's part of the value that the Rocked Marketplace brings. There are other partners who might have pre-existing relationships with some advertisers. Now, we have thousands of advertisers that we work with. So often a partner comes to us and says, oh, well, here's a preferred advertiser. Like, well, that's great. They're already part of our network and we can work with them on that. If it's a new advertiser, then we can pretty quickly onboard that advertiser on the demand side of our platform, just like all the other advertisers. And once that's done, now the marketplace just does its thing. And so let's say that advertiser, for example, is like, I only want to advertise on that partner who brought me to the Rocked table, so to speak. Well, all of our existing marketplace controls can allow that sort of narrow one-to-one matching if that's what the clients want.
Thanks for those. Well, that's all the questions I wanted to run through. If anybody wants to probe further or has got a use case they want to run past you, how do they reach out? You know, how do they find more info?
Oh, well, anyone can go to rocked.com. We have lots of information there. We have integration guides. We have case studies learn more, plenty of learn more opportunities where people can click and provide their information. And our business development and customer success teams would be happy to hear from people who are interested in learning more about the Rocked solution.
Cool. Well, thanks for your time, Bill. Much appreciated. I hope you enjoy the rest of your day. And thanks everyone for listening. Always appreciate it. Keep your ear open for our next episode. We drop one every Tuesday. And do remember to give us that rating wherever you're listening and watching. It really does help our visibility. Thanks very much, everybody. For more information on this topic, head over to replatform.fm for our audio podcasts. To discuss a project, or if you'd like to chat about any of the topics covered in this episode in more detail, please reach out to myself, James Gerd, or my co-host, Paul Rogers, via LinkedIn and Twitter. Thanks again for listening, and keep your ears peeled for the next episode.